Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Bear Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left, as always, is my Lancastrian co-host, Joe Nutsy Nuttall. So Joe, mate, how's your day been so far?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, mate. Not really done much so far today. I mean, it's pretty late, to be fair. Just not really done a lot, but obviously, the Ashes squad was announced the other day. I feel like we should address that. That was interesting, to say the least. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Aaron. For me, I thought it was certainly very interesting.
Well, to be fair, Joe, I mean, overall, decent squad. I mean, our guest
overall,
today...
a lot of it was, pretty guessable, I reckon. But I think there's a few surprise absences there, perhaps.
Potentially, Joe. To be honest, though, we'll save that for our weekly review show. I think we'll go into that in
definitely,
a bit more
depth. I'd address that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the cricket news, isn't it? Of course, when there's no county cricket on,
yeah,
we have to address
definitely
the wider cricketing, environment, I suppose. But yeah, we'll cover that in a review show, listeners. Because today, instead of doing our weekly review show, we're, of course, joined by a very, very special guest. Now, some of you may recognise him from his exploits for Hampshire or indeed for England. And it is an absolute pleasure to welcome on Hampshire and England leg spin wizard, Mason Crane. So Mason, first things first, mate, thank you very much for joining us here on the podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on for a chat. And again, I'll ask you the exact same question, mate. How's your day been so far?
Well, thanks for having me on. Not done a whole lot, to be honest. In a bit of a weird period after the season's ended, to be honest. Nothing really to do, and it feels quite strange, but obviously nice to have a bit of time to sort of do nothing really after a pretty hectic few months.
Well, it has been, hasn't it? An incredibly, incredibly hectic season, to say the least. Started all the way back with pre-season in March and, of course, finished last week, October, with the Bob Willis Trophy final. Warwickshire, of course, emerging victorious in that one, AJ. It was a fantastic end to the season, but it really, really has been a long but incredibly memorable season. And of course, as today's podcast goes on, Mason, we will address that in a lot more detail. But before we get into all of that good stuff then, just for the listeners out there, the contents of today's podcast will basically be a chat with Mason about his earliest cricketing memories. Then, of course, we'll get into a discussion about Hampshire and England. And then we'll round off today's episode with some Twitter fan questions that were sent in earlier today. But Mason, before we get into all of that then, let's transport you all the way back to the origin of the Mason Crane cricketing journey. So what were your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching this wonderful game?
My first memories, to be honest, I'm not really from a real cricketing family. No one else really plays. So for me, it was just watching the telly and when I was about eight, I guess, obviously that 2005 Ashes series was going on. So I remember vividly watching that, seeing that and not watching the series too much, but especially that last day at the Oval, I just remember it being huge news everywhere. And sort of mum and dad, who they're not at all followers of cricket, and they don't, back then, didn't know too much about it, but even they were rushing home to get it on the telly. So I remember that. And then I got that box set for Christmas that year, and would have watched that over and over and over and over, as anyone round about my age probably did as well. And just got going from there, really. So, yeah, I was probably 8 or 9 when I started getting into it.
Fair play, Mason. And, of course, a fantastic, fantastic series, one which gets brought up all the time here on the County Cricket Podcast. Unfortunately for myself and Joe, a bit too young for it. Only just, of course, but our first series was 2009, which, again, was a good series for England. But 2005 had it all. And one of the funniest moments from that series, it was that final day at the Oval. And it was when they're going off a bad light towards the end. And all of the Australia fans started putting their sunglasses on, and all the England fans started getting the umbrellas out. It was absolutely brilliant theatre for an extraordinary series. And because we brought it up, Mason, we have to ask the perennial question. What was your highlight from the 2005 Ashes? There's so, so many moments to choose from. But if you had to choose one that you could be there, live it all over again, what would it be and why?
I could live it all over again. Do you know what? There are a few, really. I mean, obviously, Edgbaston sticks out, that game and that final day and stuff. But for me, I think it was one I really enjoyed, and the game that, obviously, when you watch it back, that comes on, I really enjoyed watching it was the Trent Bridge win, where England were chasing 115 or 20 or something, and it was great because obviously England got over the line, but just the way that like Warne just sort of, he came on pretty early in that and just sort of took the game by the scruff of the neck, and you know, that was just brilliant there. The way that he was obviously didn't have much to play with, and was, that's just him at full tilt, and you had sort of Brett Lee bowling really, really quick at the other end, and obviously England trying to get it over and done with. So yeah, like I said, there's so many moments to choose from, but when I watch it back, I do enjoy watching that final day there.
Fair enough. It's a good choice. And one moment from Trent Bridge, I don't think any of us will ever forget. Gary Pratt running out Ricky Ponting. He still plays, by the way, Gary Pratt. Plays
he
for
played
Cumberland.
Against Lancs, I think.
He did, yeah.
I'm pretty sure he played against Lancs in that One Day Cup warm-up game.
He did, so, Joe. Correct. Yeah. Up in Sedbergh, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was.
Yeah, well, he cemented his court icon status there, didn't he, with that incredible run out. And, of course, Ponting going up, having a bit of verbals at Duncan Fletcher. What an incredible moment that was from an English perspective. And, of course, Mason, you mentioned the great man there, Shane Warne. Just the 708 test wickets, not a bad bowler at all. Was he your real idol in those early days when it came to cricket? Was he the one? Or did you have any other kind of role models, you know, in the cricketing world, icons that you tried to emulate in those formative years, per se?
No, well, if I'm being honest, he was, yeah. Obviously, like I said, I was pretty new to cricket. I didn't obviously know too much about it before I started playing. And so once I'd sort of realised I was a leg spinner, obviously he, at the time, was the obvious one to go to. Like, you know, there wasn't, for being honest, a whole lot of other leg spinners around in Test cricket and international cricket and stuff. So, you know, it's him. And then obviously when I started obviously going to games, I was slightly older than that, was about the time where Mushtaq Ahmed was taking 100 wickets a year at Hove. So I had a few afternoons down there watching him do his thing as well. So, you know, sort of worn from a distance, and more up close, I would say Mushy.
Well, fair enough, Mason. Two absolutely outstanding choices there. Mushtaq Ahmed, of course, a county cricket legend down on the south coast, and then Shane Warne, of course, again for your county of Hampshire, captained the side, didn't he? Famously captained the side, funnily enough, in Stratford-upon-Avon as well, in what I believe was the final game there. So who knows, we might see Stratford again. It's a beautiful ground, Swansness Lane, but yeah, for the time being, Shane Warne did appear in one of the final games at that venue. And to be honest, Mason, I think that's a beautiful transition into our discussion about leg spin. And for those of you who know the podcast before, I can talk about spin bowling for hours. So I'll try my best not to. But in terms of leg spin as an art form, Mason, what drew you in the first place? What was it about leg spin bowling that was so attractive, so appealing, as opposed to off spin, seam bowling, or indeed just being a specialist batsman? Why was leg spin so enticing to you personally?
Well, to me, it wasn't really like a choice to bowl leg spin. That is what I bowled when I started playing. That's just sort of how it went. And I think pretty early on would have been one of the, when I first started, these coaches was like, you bowl leg spin. And I was like, all right, well, better do my research then and find out what that is. You know, like I said, that's what I did. I was pretty good at it, and just rolled with it from there. And obviously, and tried to learn about all the great leg spinners and how they go about it and stuff. And that's, you know, it's why I say, like, a lot of the time people tell me it's like really difficult. I don't really understand that, because I really bowl. So for me, it's not, it doesn't feel like I'm doing something really difficult. It just feels like this is what cricket is to me, if you know what I mean. So, but yeah, to be honest, I just loved it to bits, and I really enjoyed everything about cricket, batting and fielding as well. I loved it all. And bowling especially, I loved bowling. I loved finding out what I could do. And, you know, like I said, it's just what happened. So I just sort of ran with it from there and see where it took me.
Well, that is a lovely journey into the game of cricket, and of course into leg spin as well, Mason. And it's funny you mention that, because a former guest here was Will Beer, of course, Sussex's all-time leading T20 wicket taker, also a leg spinner. And he was the exact same. In fact, he used to be a seam bowler, but he always bowled leg cutters. So his coach basically just said, get into leg spin. And of course, that journey has taken him to the pinnacle of Sussex's T20 wicket-taking charts. And You alluded to it beforehand as well. I'd love to know your opinion about this, Mason. The apparent lack of leg spinners, in particular in Test cricket, not just right now, but I suppose at times over the years as well. Because I'm just thinking nowadays, in terms of teams that really do play a specialist leg spinner, you got Yasir Shah for Pakistan, you got Rashid Khan for Afghanistan. And then other than that, there aren't really any, you know, specialist leg spinners anymore. If we think back to the early 2000s, for example, you'd have Kumbley, you'd have Shane Warne, for example. Mushtaq did play for Pakistan. You just seem to have more choices. Do you think there's anything behind the decrease, per se, in the number of leg spinners? Why do you think that's happened in the last few years?
Well, I think there's two reasons, to be honest. I think the first reason is obviously white ball cricket. If you're a good leg spinner now, obviously you tend to do better in white ball cricket. And to be honest, a lot of leg spinners now probably look at it and they've changed the way that they would have bowled a few years ago. A lot now are obviously a bit flatter and stuff like that, and obviously try and bowl a bit shorter and quicker, which lends itself to white ball and T20 cricket, but ultimately is not what you want to be doing in four-day cricket. So they don't get in the sides anyway, because they've changed their style, sort of thing. And then the second thing is the way that four-day cricket and red ball cricket's played nowadays, especially, is, you know, it's, like I said, maybe T20 cricket's had a big influence. And I personally feel, you know, there's a lot of four-day cricket now is trying to just bowl dot balls and just hoping that, you know, someone plays a bad shot, or one just moves off the pitch, or whatever, that you're waiting for something to happen in that way now, as opposed to sort of Test cricket in the early thousands was like, you know, setting someone up with away swingers and stuff like that. It's now all about dot balls and they'll play a rash shot. And obviously if you land 6 out of 6 as a finger spinner, you're more likely to bowl dot balls. And you know, if, you know, it's a lot easier, I think, for off spinner and their natural variation. I think it's easier for them to make a ball go dead straight on, for example. And that's just the way the game's played now. And I think white ball cricket's probably brought that in, the way batters play. They can hit more balls for four than they used to be able to. But that also means that they go chasing after balls that 20 years ago people just leave alone. So I think those two things combined. I think if you're a young leg spinner now, obviously it's T20 cricket and 50 over cricket. It's the obvious route to go down.
It is indeed, Mason. And I'm so, so happy you gave us some insight into that, because I was just listening to that. And it is interesting, isn't it? Because there are different causes. And I just think back to England versus Pakistan in 2020, Shadab Khan, for example. And they actually did a comparison between him and Yasir Shah. And he was bowling a lot fuller and a lot more googlies, which, of course, in T20 cricket is going to suit you very, very well, because batsmen are attacking you. They're going to come down the track, or they're going to chop on, et cetera, et cetera. But in Test cricket, he hasn't had the same success as Yasir Shah. And I suppose the question I wanted to ascertain from that was, how does your approach actually change from first class to white ball bowling? Because you seem to be aggressive in both. Of course, we can get your stats up from this season later on and discuss that in more depth. But does your approach change that much? And if so, in what ways does it change between formats?
Well, this is sort of the biggest thing I've been trying to work on the last sort of year or so, is obviously my sort of approach to the whole game, because obviously T20 cricket and 50 over cricket, as a leg spinner, you sort of, you just get your variations out and you know, just sort of you go through what you've got, really, and you know, you try and spin the balls as much as you can, and you know, they're going to be playing shots to you, so you know what's coming. You just get as much on it as you can, and you use your variations, and if you miss slightly short, it's not the end of the world. Slightly full, might get a wicket, might go out the ground, you know, that's just the game now. But four-day cricket is very much the opposite of that. It's about landing, you know, 6 good balls and asking them to play a good forward defence every ball. And I think in the past, something I've done wrong is I've chased it slightly too, I've chased it too much at times. And if we've played on a pretty good wicket, a pretty flat wicket, I've thought maybe I need to try and make something happen, try and get a wicket. And obviously leads to leaking runs and stuff. And something I've got better at this year is a bit more patience, almost trying to put other deliveries to one side. So I'm not going to bowl them until I need to later on. You know, if I land my leg spinner over and over and over again, keep asking questions, That's how you're going to get them out in four-day cricket, whereas in white ball cricket, you're going to get them out by missing the middle of the bat. So, yeah, it's such a different mindset. And I think they're probably getting further and further away from each other, if I'm being brutally honest.
Well, that is very, very interesting to hear, Mason. And of course, for our audio listeners out there, you won't be able to see this, but I'm grinning very, very much so here, because this is brilliant. I love all things spin. I'm an off-spinner by nature, and I do agree off-spin is easier, in particular with a straight ball, because you can go for an arm ball, for example. But it is an interesting art. I love leg spin. Like, the fact is, we've grown up with so many fantastic leg spinners, not just in county cricket, but on a global scale as well. Warne, Cumbly, Ahmed, for example, Rashid Khan, Adil Rashid as well. We've got some great spinners in county cricket right now. Yourself, Mason, Matt Parkinson, Jake Lintott. There is something magical about leg spin. There really is. And before I ask you, Mason, as the professional, I want to ask the podcast host first. So, Joe, here's a question for you, mate. What do you think is the most important weapon of the leg spinner's arsenal? Is it variation? Is it drift? Is it turn? What do you think is the most valuable asset for a leg spinner in the modern game?
Well, I'm going to say this more from a, like, as if I'm watch, just what I prefer to watch, right? So, I mean, I think it's great when, you know, a leg spinner gets a lot of drift, and the drift itself almost foxes a batsman. But for me, just watching a leg spinner bowl a great googly. Like, if you think of Adil Rashid, for me, he's the best at bowling a googly. And it's just eight impossible to pick, I always find. Even watching it on TV when you're behind, you know, you're watching it almost from behind the bowler's arm, it's impossible to pick. Or maybe that's just me anyway. But it just looks good, doesn't it, when a batsman just completely misses a googly. It's just a good thing to watch. So for me, it's variation. But yeah, I don't know about you two as well, but for me, it's definitely variation.
Interesting. Go on, Mason. What do you say in terms of the leg spinner's arsenal? Ideally, of course, as a professional, you have, you know, a mix of all of them. But what do you say is the real key asset? What is the spearhead of the leg spinner's arsenal?
I mean, like I said, it sort of depends on the format slightly. But one thing I would say, no matter what the format, I'm always trying to spin the ball. I just think, you know, like, there's a lot now, like, people slide it out the front of the hand and stuff, and that's, maybe it's just because it's just that's not me. That's not what I'm going to be trying to do. But you know, for me, it's just about spin. I just think if I don't spin it, then I'm bowling like 50 mile an hour, early 50 mile an hour. It's like a throwdown in the morning. I don't see how it doesn't go for six all the time. And I say that to the batters as well. And especially white ball cricket, if someone doesn't spin it, I say, well, how do you? If I just threw your ball, I said it's not going to spin. You just hit it into the stands. Why aren't you doing that? You know, like, I feel like a sitting duck if it doesn't spin. So, yeah, for me, it'd have to be spin.
Fair enough. I suppose depend on the bowler, doesn't it? Because another...
Definitely. I think it's individual, isn't it? I think it's personal preference.
It is indeed, Joe. And of course, yeah. I mean, one of our former guests here on the podcast was Chris Green, who is more of an arm ball specialist. He doesn't really turn the ball. So for him, it's more about consistency. It's more about landing that arm ball, you know, in the block hole, the Yorker length, in white ball cricket in particular. And it is interesting, isn't it? Again, this is why I love spin bowling so much. You've got the variation, you've got the spin, you've got the flight, you've got the deception, you've got the guile, you've got the setup as well. There's just so many different complexities to the art of spin bowling. I find it fascinating. I really do. I'm not sure if that's just me, folks. I mean, do either of you two, again, are you like that? Or am I just being a bit, you know, of a badger, shall we say?
It's just so good to watch, isn't it? When you're watching, you know, I mean... Well, we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but the spell that you bowled against Lanxmason at Egbeth, I mean, it obviously didn't go, you know, your way in the end, but, I mean, it was such a gripping, half an hour, 40 minutes of cricket. So I think that's what, for me, that's the most entertaining thing about spin is something different is going to happen every time. And certainly in white ball cricket, you know, something different is going to happen every single ball. And obviously in red ball cricket, it's maybe more drawn out, maybe over a few overs. But in white ball cricket, in a T20 game, you've got four overs. You've got to try and make something happen. And that's what's so interesting for me. And of course, it's like that about... It's the same with seamers. But for me, I don't know, spinners, as you say, just so much more deceptive, I think, and so much more harder to pick. So yeah, I think for me, that's how I would view it. But just while actually we're on the topic, I do have a question for you, Mason. Who would you say is, in your opinion, the best leg spinner right now, excluding yourself, the best leg spinner right now in county cricket? I mean, surely there's only, I'm hoping there's only one right answer here, and I would rank you and this other person in the top two. So
it's Jake Lintott, isn't it?
Well, it's Parky, isn't it, for me? I just, you know, Parky was, yeah, obviously know him really well. He's brilliant, Parky. He always has been as well from young age. We're the same age, and yeah, I can remember sort of from under 12s, just he's had the same celebration since then, and every time he used to turn around when we were 12, he was doing it again. And yeah, no, I think Parky's a fabulous bowler, and while we're on it, I think he's probably a little bit unlucky to not be in the Ashes squad.
Definitely, 100%, 100%.
Yep. That's not just Joe either. I'm going to be honest, I would think the exact same. And the T20 World Cup squad in the UAE.
And the T20 World Cup squad. Mm. And yeah, both of them. And actually, is there anyone who's maybe more up and coming, or not necessarily just leg spinners, but just spinners in general on the county circuit, who's maybe more up and coming, and you've only just come across a couple of times? I can think of maybe one or two off the top of my head here.
Does one of them play for Sussex?
He does, yeah, and another one obviously plays for Lancs. But yeah, are there anyone who you maybe think of, Mason, who maybe up and coming, just spinners in general?
Yeah, well, like probably the two that you're probably thinking of. I think Archie Lenham at Sussex, he looks really good, and that's always exciting to see. And then probably Hartley from Lancs as well. Just thought particularly. Obviously, we don't play the Northern teams in T20 unless we get to a finals day or something with them. And sadly, none of them made it this year. But
unfortunately,
in the 100, he looked really good. And yeah, no, he looks like a very clever bowler, but he's got a lot of skill. So
He bowls a good pace as well.
He's got good attributes. He's tall as well, so he's got a lot going for him.
100%, 100%. Aaron, anyone who think maybe we've maybe missed there?
Well, remember the resident Warwickshire co-host, Joe. Have to say Jacob Bethel, don't I? The boy is an absolute superstar in the making, 17 years of age. Fair enough, he's more of an all-rounder, to be honest, as opposed to an out-and-out spinner.
Still counts.
He does still count because his left-arm off-spinners are very, very, you know, they're very, very useful indeed. And of course, in terms of some more young spinners, I know he's been on the circuit a little bit longer, but Amar Verdi, absolutely brilliant off-spinner, in particular in Red Bull cricket. Dan Moriarty, of course, who had a breakthrough season in 2020. When I was actually thinking about this the other day, we have got so many fantastic spinners in county cricket right now. I know they aren't so much up and coming, Joe. I know you're thinking more of, you know, teenage spinners, but look at Liam Paterson-White. Look at Callum Parkinson. Look at Danny Briggs as well. I know he's slightly older, but
even arguably Don Best as well. Don Best is only, what, 20? Is he the same age as you, Don Best? Mason, yeah. I think he's 24.
Yeah, yeah, Best, same age, yeah. In an ideal world, I think you'd, you know, there'd be somewhere between 18 and 25 good spinners, because obviously every team should have one. I personally can't see a scenario. I can't see a reason why you wouldn't want to have a good spinner as a cricket team at any level, to be honest. So, you know, you'd hope that each county A, has one or tries to get one, and B, invests in them somewhat to try and make them as good as they can, because everyone knows you need a good spinner in any format. But there was talk about a good spinner to win the championship and stuff, and you know, like Harmer, he bowls half the overs for Essex and they win the thing. It's not a surprise because he's the best spinner in the country and he's bowling half your overs. So, you know, that's something that I think all counties should absolutely be thinking about.
100%, Mason. Could not have put that much better. And obviously, listeners, I think you can tell, all three of us members of the Spinners Union, if you can already tell by the spinners bias on display in today's podcast. But it's a good point. And again, we are very passionate about spin bowling here on the County Cricket Podcast, because it's a wonderful art form. And to be honest, I do feel like over the years, not so much just in county cricket, but also on the international stage, I feel like in English cricket in particular, it hasn't quite been given the love and attention and nurturing that I think it could have had, to be completely honest. We've had some excellent spinners over the years, but in terms of at grassroots level, in terms of in domestic cricket as well, I just feel like certain things in particular, that, you know, the timings of championship games, for example, there aren't any in the middle of summer where pitches would be turning at their most. I just feel like that is something which could be worked on heading into the future, but of course, only time will tell. We'll have to wait and see what happens with the scheduling and, of course, with regards to our attitude, I suppose, to spin bowling here in England and Wales. And, of course, talking about county cricket, Mason, we've spoken there quite a bit about international cricket and, of course, up-and-coming county players. But What were your first ever memories of county cricket in terms of the circuit itself, and in particular Hampshire? What were your first memories in that regard?
Probably, like I said earlier, really, probably watching Mushy at Hove. Yeah, obviously, I'm originally from Sussex, moved over here when I was about 14, 15. But yeah, it would have been that. And I remember one of the first times I went down there, they I think it was 2006, and they won it. And I remember the Sussex team on the balcony with the championship and in that sort of thing. And they I mean, Murray Goodwin hitting a six to win a maybe 40 over competition or something like that. But yeah, about that time really, and watching Sussex, and then obviously before I moved over to Hampshire. But no, I really enjoyed it, and it was one of those where it was like the day out at Hove, I just thoroughly enjoyed, and sort of T20 nights on a Friday night going down there and stuff. Yeah, just saw it and just thought, no, this is pretty cool. Hopefully I get to play in it one day.
And then of course you did. Funny how life turns out, isn't it, Mason? Yeah. I suppose from those formative years. And of course that Sussex team, mid to late 2000s, absolutely superb, of course, coached by Don Robbo himself, Mark Robinson, Warwickshire's head coach as well. So very, very good times down on the south coast, those in 2006 and 2007, when they did the double. And Mason, I have to ask this about Hove. Is that the most partisan crowd in the country? Or do you think there's another place which maybe tops in terms of really quite vocal, vociferous home support and then almost silence for away support? What do you say has the most partisan crowd in this country?
Well, there's quite a few. To be honest, we're getting quite a few now. In terms of like the difference between the home team and the away team, Canterbury's up there for me. Like, you know, even like the music just doesn't play when it feels like the speakers always stop working when we hit a boundary there, and they double the volume when Kent hit a four. But no, Essex is obviously a bit of a raucous atmosphere, or can be. And then, yeah, obviously Old Trafford as well in the 100 this year was especially like, yeah, loud. And, you know, I know it's the 100 and it's a new team, but the way that they got behind, their side in that, you know, I obviously haven't played a T20 there for Hampshire, but Lord only knows what they're like when Lancashire are playing Yorkshire.
Well, Joe, you can tell us from experience.
That is the best derby. You will not find a better derby in cricket. Well, I mean, in county cricket anyway. You will not. For me, it goes the Roses game, and then now, and I'd like to get your opinion on this. Actually, the name El Clasico, which personally is a brilliant name.
It's a good name.
Are those derbies as good as they look on TV? Because personally, I've never been to one, but you know, on TV, it was a great atmosphere and always a great game. Two great teams. Are they actually as good as they look playing in them?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say, like, you know, obviously, it is a big derby. I wouldn't, like, we're a derby because we're close to them. Like, we're not, if you know what I mean, not from like nothing's happened.
Not like a hatred kind of
thing. No, like not like a rivalry. It's like, it is a derby.
No. It's more just like a friendly derby kind of thing.
Yeah. But no, it's good. And I think because we're quite close, you do get a bit of a crossover of the fans as well. Like quite a few people make the trip and stuff. So yeah, no, I always enjoy those games because you're just desperate not to lose, really, more than anything else.
Is that the one game you always look out for? Because I know for Lancs and Yorkshire players, I assume Yorkshire and Worcester players, they always look out for their respective, you know, derbies, if you like. Is that what you always look out for? Is there another team who you look forward to playing the most?
Yeah, no, I think I look at those games and they tend to be like Sky games as well. Which obviously in county cricket are becoming sort of increasingly less often.
Less,
I feel like when I first started playing, like we were on Sky every other game, and now it's like one a year. But yeah, no, they always just tend to be a bit bigger, and like, you know, you do get a few more in, like the crowds are bigger, understandably. And yeah, no, they're just a slightly sort of bigger and better day than normal.
Mm-hmm. They certainly do live up to the hype, don't they? Derby days are absolutely fantastic for us as fans as well. I mean, John, I know you'd say the same about the Roses derby. I'd say the same.
Yeah, 100%.
About Bears versus Pears, especially when your team wins. That's always, you know, puts a nice smile on the face, give you bragging rights amongst some of your friendship circles as well. And Mason, in terms of your career with Hampshire, what do you say has been your highlight? Would it be your debut, for example, or, you know, would it be a memorable El Clasico's victory? What do you say over the years has been your real career highlights with the Southern County?
Well, we won the 50 over trophy in 2018. That was like a great day.
Can we talk about one moment from that?
We can, yeah, yeah.
Your run outs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to say, really. I see, going back, like, I don't know if you know, but I was playing through a stress fracture then. Had an injection and stuff that day. So I knew my season was over no matter what happened. And I was having quite a few problems. Like, I only bowled 7 or 8 overs. I didn't actually bowl that well. Don't know if that was down to sort of the pain or what. And I remember I was cramping up everywhere because I essentially hadn't really moved for 2 or 3 weeks. And yeah, I just remember like the physio was just on the boundary the whole sort of the whole time, feeding me gels and trying to sort of decramp me. So I was really battling with it. And it was just one of those where just like I said, I knew the season was over for me. So I was more than happy to sort of try and play through anything I could, and just sort of glided towards it. Like, felt $1 million for a few seconds. And just let go of it, threw it as hard as I could. And it was almost like, it was the moment the ball was sort of on its way, that's when the pain started to kick back in, and realised where I was. So I couldn't celebrate too much. I was sort of stuck where I was. But and that was a really good moment from just an overall great day. Such a great memory. And we had so many homegrown players in that team and in that tournament. It was just brilliant. And, you know, it's a shame that we couldn't do the same the year after, obviously lost in the final. But that's got to be, at the moment, the highlight. I thought at one stage this year it was going to be just the whole end of this season, really. I mean, at one point we were staring at doing the double, and it was all cruelly taken away from us at the end. So if we'd got over the line in one of those, it probably would have been that.
It can be a cruel game, though, can't it, cricket? It's one of those, it lulls you into this false sense of hope and security, and then it's, you know, pulls the proverbial rug from underneath your feet. Trust me, I know that. As an RCB fan in the IPL, trust me, 3 losing finals. I've watched every single one, right? So I know exactly how that feels when, you know, you think you're going to win something and all of a sudden something happens and everything goes wrong. It's one of those, but that's the nature of the sport, I suppose. It is part and parcel of the wonderful game of cricket. I'm going to be honest, I didn't know you had that stress fracture during the game. I'm going to be honest, I thought that happened after, because that kept you out for the rest of the season. But I mean, was that during the game itself, or how long, well, before the game, I suppose, did you know that you'd suffer that injury?
Quite a while. I'd known it probably for a couple of weeks, and I had...
Weeks?
No, I wasn't playing cricket. The last group game, I think, was when it sort of first came on. I didn't actually... I was in the squad for a 4-day game. So yeah, it would have been about 2 or 3 weeks. I was in the squad for a 4-day game, and the day before I went to try and bowl, and I just couldn't bowl. I just couldn't. I remember I just couldn't do it. So I said, look, I don't know what's gone on here, but, you know, something's not right. And obviously scan after scan and stuff, as they do. As he found out that I'd sort of had a repeat of the stress fracture I got on the test tour in New Zealand earlier in the year. So then we sort of just at a crossroads, really, and we just took the decision that, you know, I could try and play through it. Obviously, knowing I was out, it wasn't going to get any worse in one game. It's just whether you could sort of deal with it. So I went up to London and had a jab in my back, tried to sort of get rid of a bit of the pain. How much it did, I don't know, but it did allow me to play. And it's just one of those, whatever I did really hurt, but I was just determined to play because I'd had such a tough time of it up until then. And I just felt like I was hitting, getting back to where I was before I was injured, and that had taken about 8 games. And so I just felt I wanted to finish off the competition and play in the final. So, yeah, I knew well before the game, that obviously it was going to be my last one. We didn't try and disclose that before the game because I didn't want Kent to just run to me every time if they knew I couldn't move. So, it's obviously tough to take at the time, but, you know, it's a long time ago now, and thankfully I'm past all of that.
Exactly. And I tell you what, Mason, fair play. deserve a lot of credit for that. Playing through an injury like a stress fracture, they are absolutely nightmarish. They really are. Of course, I speak from, you know, being a Warwickshire fan. Ollie Stone has struggled with them for years, and they really do set you back so, so much. And they take ages as well. The recovery, the rehab associated with stress fractures are some of the longest when it comes to cricket injuries. So full respect to you for that. And would you say that's probably your toughest moment in cricket? Or would you say there's one that's topped it for you, Percy, so far in your cricketing journey?
That was tough. That was obviously really, really tough to deal with. One thing I think about stress fractures, obviously you're out for so long, but it probably takes the same amount of time again to get back to where you should be cricket-wise. So something I struggled with big time was the year after when I came back and I just couldn't bowl the same. And I had a really tough year of it. And I remember I really shouldn't have been playing, especially championship cricket, I really shouldn't have been playing much of it. I played a few games when Dawson was at the World Cup. And I just wasn't bowling the same. It looked like I couldn't get any like power behind the ball. I felt like I was bowling too slowly. I felt like my action wasn't quite right, but obviously didn't really trust my body yet to sort of properly bowl. And so that was probably tougher to deal with because you come back from injury, and you're like, well, I've lost it. Sort of what I had back then, I'm not going to get that back. Obviously, in time, it does get better and you do learn to trust yourself a bit more and stuff. But yeah, probably up until the winter before COVID, if I'm being honest, I was probably struggling with it quite a bit. And I think just the time afterwards was up. So you declared fit, you start playing games. Obviously, the actual outcome isn't really the front of your mind. You just want to get through the game because you don't want to be injured again and go through it all. And if I'm being honest, I probably shouldn't have, I probably didn't deserve to play as many games as I did that season. But, that's why for me, I sort of look at my career in two parts now. I sort of look at it as that early bit. And probably since, the end of 2019, 2020 started until now, this period where I've sort of been fully fit the whole time. And I sort of starting to feel back to where I was when I was sort of 2021.
Well, that is fantastic news, Mason. It really is. I'm very, very happy. And of course, touch wood, that you do remain fully fit, of course, for the foreseeable future. And now that those times are over, I suppose, it's positive, isn't it? Because it's incredibly tough to get over injuries. As I said, Ollie Stone, for example, has dealt with so, so many. Like, it really does take a lot out of you, but you're on the road to recovery, the correct road in the game of cricket. And of course, that road has taken you to 2021. And 2021 has been, shall we say, a memorable season, to say the least, across all three formats. To be honest, Glamorgan, for example, winning their first trophy in 17 years, Kent winning the T20 Blast, and then, of course, the mighty, mighty Warwickshire winning their first championship in 9 years. And, Mason, how would you describe the 2021 season? I know, Joe, you'll want to talk about one particular game towards the end of the championship, in particular, up in Liverpool. But in terms of the season as a whole and your performances, Mason, how would you describe it in your own words?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is, like, it's a bit of relief really that it's happened. Obviously, we had last season was so disrupted that we didn't really have a too much of a season, and this year, just to be even if we go back to the start of the season, we're all a bit unsure what was going to be allowed and what we were going to be able to do, and things are we gonna have to stop again, stuff like that. But a bit of relief really. It's all come through. Everything seems to have gone really well. Having crowds back was just amazing. I never really realised, to be honest, how much of a difference it does make. But having played last year in front of no one, they're tough games to get through, to be honest. And, especially last year, 20 overs has never felt so long to field when there's just no one in the ground. And, all that sort of stuff coming together, and it's sort of, getting back to normal, really. That was just such a positive for me. And I know every other player would absolutely feel the same. So, that was brilliant. And then the cricket that was played, I thought was excellent, to be honest. We had so much happen, obviously the championship, different format and stuff, but that was a very exciting finish. And T20 and finals day was brilliant as well. And obviously the launch of the 100 as well. So, yeah, there's been plenty going on. It's not normal, but it's close enough, and it's been a really good year, I think, overall.
Well, that is phenomenal to hear, Mason. It really is, and as you said, it wasn't quite, 100% normal. I mean, fans weren't allowed back until May for county championship matches, and then, of course, reduced capacity crowds in the Blast, but fingers crossed 2022, back to a bit more normality. Maybe some full crowds for the T20 Blast, Sweet Caroline ringing around grounds across the country. There's not much better, to be honest, in my personal opinion. And of course, with that title race, we now know the outcome of that, of course, Warwickshire winning it. But there was an extraordinary game, in particular towards the end of the season, up in Egbeth. And Joe, I'll pass over to you now, mate. What were your thoughts on that game? And of course, do you have any questions about that incredible encounter?
Yeah, well, personally, I mean, I don't think there would have been a team who didn't deserve to win. I think Lancs obviously won. Lancs deserved it. If Hampshire had won, you would have deserved it. So I don't think you could really say anything against that. I think it really was an incredible game of cricket. I'm glad Lancs won and came out on top. But just from a not really a neutral perspective. I'm not neutral in this, but from a more unbiased look at it, just as a game of cricket, it was a great advert. It really was. And the fact that it was at a club ground as well, I think, was also really impressive, because typically club grounds are not, they're obviously good. They're obviously good enough to host first-class games, but it's not Old Trafford or the Aegeus Bowl, is it? So I think to play a game like that on a club ground was real testament, actually, to the groundsman at, I don't know if it was a Lancs groundsman who prepared the pitch or the groundsman at Egbeth, but whoever it was, brilliant. And I think one question I actually have been interested to know is, why did you open the batting, Mason? Because, what was the reason behind that? You obviously had that incredible knock against Yorkshire where, I don't remember the exact number of balls you faced now, but it was obviously that. And then, yeah, is it something to do with that?
Well, it's an interesting one. Like you mentioned that knock against Yorkshire. I was actually meant to do it in that game as well. So I came in as night watcher at number four. But the original plan, I think, was for me to open in that game. But we had Brad Will and Carl Abbott were injured, so they both couldn't bat. So that meant there was no one left to do night watchman. So against Yorkshire, we took the decision we weren't going to do it so that I could do night watchman if needed. And obviously, batted for a long time the next day and sort of bored everyone to death. But, did my job sort of thing. And same at Egbeth, really. I think I faced 100 balls in the first innings again. And it was just a thought that, the new ball was the hardest time to bat. And, we were just thinking, well, if I do get through 30 balls, or if I get through, Bailey's opening spell or half of his opening spell, does that give the middle order a better chance? Does that mean that someone in the middle order doesn't have to face the new ball and they got more chance of scoring more runs than me later on? And if I'm being honest, I know it's quite rogue, it's out there. Yeah, but
very innovative though. I really like the idea.
I've got to say my view my personal view on it is it's a batting order is not set in stone. It doesn't matter. No. It's just whoever's coming in next. So it's literally you have a go next. It doesn't, never understood when people, I need to bat four. If anything, it should be, I need to bat after over 15, or I need to come in between 20 and 30 overs. That's what you really mean by that. And I just think, why wouldn't you move your chess pieces around more?
I don't think Lancs were expecting that. When I saw you walking out to open the batting, I was not expecting that. And I'm very surprised if the Lancs coaching staff, players, anything new, had any inkling that it was going to happen. So
no, well, that's like, obviously, Egbeth, we have to walk past their balcony to get on the field. And, some of the looks I got, like I said, it was a surprise. And it's just a different thing to do. And people don't do it very much and whatever. But, like I said, why would you not move your pieces around? If it gives Vincent Dawson a better chance to score runs later on, why wouldn't you? Because ultimately I'm never going to come in and be a massive stroke maker and make loads of runs later on. you know, if the conditions ease off later, then if anything, I'm just going to block it. But if the conditions ease off and two batters are in, you know, they could score more runs. And ultimately, that's what the game's about. So I completely see the logic. And, you know, to be honest, I also see how it's, you know, it's not a normal thing to do and stuff. But, you know, sadly, it didn't really work. But, you know, if it had, obviously, it'd be like, you know, genius move of the year. So
exactly.
Yeah, that's the risk you take.
It is.
100%. And I guess, yeah, like I said, I'd imagine Lanx had no idea that it was going to happen. So it really, I think that's probably a unique thing. Can we expect to see more of this in the future from, I mean, dare I say, Mason Crane, the all-rounder at some point?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't expect it every game. If I'm being honest, I think it was a pretty unique scenario in that, you know, obviously the scores were low. It was so difficult against the new ball. You know, like it was honestly, you know, it was as tough conditions I think you're probably likely to get against new balls. And yeah, it's a pretty unique scenario. So I wouldn't expect it every game, but you know, the option's there, and I'll never say no if they want me to do it. Obviously, so
100%. And I actually often think that people who bat lower down rather than in the middle order. I mean, let's compare yourself against James Vince. Let's say I often think you're more likely to face the new ball at 80 overs than he is, because technically, if a team gets bowled out, you're more likely to come in at 80 overs and be batting then. Than he is. Not to say James Vince is going to get out all the time, because I mean, personally, I think he was a shout for the Ashes. I would have taken him to the Ashes anyway, but that's a different debate. But I often think, you know, people who bat lower are more likely to face the new ball in red ball cricket than people who bat in the middle order, just because you get a new ball after 80 overs. So I don't know. I mean, I thought that as well when Jack Leach got his 92. He's had a bit of practice against the new ball. That was incredible. Did you have visions of yourself scoring a big ton?
Never thought about that, because I wasn't at all thinking about runs. I just thought, you know, the one thing going through my mind was, if I get out driving here, that does look stupid. You know, I was absolutely trying to block every ball and just see how long I could go for. But yeah, you know, it's like you said, you probably are quite likely down the order to face a new ball. You know, the only difference being obviously the bowlers obviously tired and have been bowling and stuff, but. Yeah, you know, like if you think like the great sort of number sevens and wicketkeeper batters and stuff, just thinking like Chris Reid, like we played him a few times and he comes out and starts lashing the new ball everywhere. You know, it's pretty demoralising, but that's what makes those guys such good players.
It does indeed. And you alluded to it there about blocking. Okay, we've spoken there about the Lancashire-Hampshire game. There was one other game in that divisional round, which, to be honest, we couldn't believe, could we, Joe? In a really, really bizarre turn of events, Mason Crane, the night watchman, I've still got the tweet actually from our Twitter account. This was at tee on day four of that game. 28 not outs from 192 balls, a 14.58 strike rate, a night watchman's dream that, and 242 minutes spent at the crease. We have to ask about that performance. How on earth would you go about describing that, Mason, in terms of the, you know, the feelings, the execution as well of just blocking, 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 blocking? What do you remember from that incredible day down on the South Coast?
Well, you know, like I said, I was not out overnight. And from going into the day, like everyone just saying, like, you know, if you, every sort of ball you last, every over, you're still there. You know, that's like, that's a thorn in their side. That's a ball someone else doesn't have to face and whatever. And they're like, you know, if you can last half an hour, 40 minutes, you know, that'd be unbelievable and stuff like that. And so I got through the first couple of overs of the day. Yeah. And I said to Vincey at the start of the day, I said, look, I'm just going to block every ball that's bowled at me. I said, I have no interest in playing attacking shot. I'm going to, you know, see, Amla did it against us early in the season and he batted the whole day for 30 odd. And I just thought, well, I'm just going to block every single ball. Obviously, runs absolutely do not matter whatsoever. So, yeah, I got in a bit of a mindset, really. I was just, every ball was a block. And, you know, like the wicket was quite slow. And, yeah, it's not like the Aegeus isn't the greatest place on earth to bowl on day four most of the time, if I'm being honest. you know, there wasn't too much bounce or pace or anything, but I just sort of got in that mindset and that good rhythm. And, you know, when I got to lunch, I was kind of like, you know, this is, I just thought this is bizarre. And I'm so mentally drained. I just remember feeling so tired just from the, like, concentrating all the time. I was thinking, like, you know, obviously bowling's more physical. You know, I could do that all day, but batting, I found it just so draining. I think what helped, I don't think many people realize this, but I think Vincey came in maybe like 15 minutes after lunch. And we never changed ends our whole partnership. We picked an end and we just stood there. I got 28. I could have got way more, but we just weren't running. I hit a couple to the sort of the boundary and we just sort of stood there and looked at each other. And it was great because I just, you know, I, when I'm on strike, I'm counting to six, just trying to get through it. And then I was just stood at the other end on my bat, knowing I'll never run. Just again, waiting until it's my turn, really, and just trying to switch off. So, it was quite a bizarre day. And I basically faced Bessie for most of that afternoon session. And I was just six blocks in a row and then sit there and watch Vincey do the same thing. And so, yeah, we batted together for pretty much 2 hours and, never changed ends once.
Well, it was a brilliant, brilliant display of fortitude, resilience, grit, dogged determination. It was fantastic to watch. And Joe, I know that's not your style. You prefer, you know, a 28 off about 12 balls, but I can appreciate that, to be honest. When you look at the great night watchman innings, you do really have to dig in as though your life depends on it.
You know what? That was a very, very good innings. That was a very, very good innings. It was the patience that must have taken to be able to even just concentrate for that long. I mean, do you have like, I don't know, you might have even developed one, Joe, not like a ritual in between opens. Like, obviously, Haseeb Hameed, for example, walks to square leg and back. Did you kind of develop something like that just to keep concentration?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'd be, I'm not as fancy as having an actual routine. I was just desperately trying to count to six, to be honest, you know, like just, desperate for the over to end most of the time so I could watch Vincey do it. But it was one of those things, really, just, you know, we had to do it. We had to survive. If we lost that game, that was probably, you know, we knew that that could have been it for us because we didn't come into the group with many points. So we knew we had to get a draw out of that game. And yeah, you know, it's just every time the thought crossed my mind, you know, that maybe done enough now, like it doesn't matter. I was just like, no, I need to carry on as long as I can. Every ball is important because that's one that someone else doesn't have to face. And luckily we got that draw and we still had a chance after that. We still had a chance to win it.
You did. And then you went and absolutely hammered us at Edgbaston in what was a very, very strange game indeed from the Raglan stand. I will say that. I mean, what an extraordinary day one that was. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it, to be honest, at Edgbaston. And in terms of that performance, we had that fantastic bit at the end where it looked almost like something that should be hung in the Louvre with Bess and Adam live bowling and all the fielders around Brad Wheel and Carl Abbott. It was absolutely fantastic. And in fact, Mason, this brings us nicely, I think, onto our concluding segment, which is, of course, the fan questions. And this is from one of our Yorkshire fans that follows us on Twitter. And he puts, no questions for Mason, but can you please tell him that his 28 from 197 balls still gives me nightmares as a Yorkshire fan? So that's quite a funny thing there from our resident Yorkshire fan. Moving on to our fan questions then. We have got a few for you just to wrap up today's podcast, Mason. One of them is from James Truscott, of course, a good friend of ours here at the podcast. He's a Hampshire fan. In fact, he was one of our first ever guests, wasn't he, Joe? James, very, very nice guy.
He loves
his cricket. And Mason, he has a question for you here with regards to leg spin. And he said, what could English cricket and the counties do better to produce and develop more leg spinners? Is there something in particular, you know, a methodology, an initiative that you think could be implemented to increase the number and quality, I suppose, of leg spinners in this country?
Well, I think a lot of it's mindset based. Like I said earlier, sort of the way four-day cricket's being played and the way a lot of teams probably go about it is all about sort of dot balls and run rate and, you know, just sort of patience really and waiting. And obviously most leg spinners aren't, that's not really their game. And, you know, you're going to get the odd one. You're going to get a parkie or someone who can bowl consistently and bowl dots from one end all day. But I think ultimately that's not it's not feasible really to expect every leg spinner to be like that. You know, I've said before on sort of another podcasts I've done where I've said people don't necessarily want a leg spinner on their side. They always want Shane Warne. You know, he's not in the same bracket as the rest of us, to be honest. And you know, I think there are definitely times where sort of a good leg spinner is invaluable, and that you know will be able to do things that finger spinners can't. You know, vice versa as well. You know, for most of the game, they're going to be able to hold and end up better than most of us. And yeah, you know, so I think it's unrealistic to expect every team to have a really good leg spinner on their side. And there's nothing you could do. There's no schedule change. There's no, tweaking of rules and fixtures that will ever bring that about. You know, we've got to accept that. But in the same breath, you know, we can absolutely enhance what we've got. You know, playing so many games in April and September is fine, but you know, as long as there's fixtures in the middle of the summer as well, you know, there's nothing wrong with playing in April and September. You know, like we just saw then, like, you know, the last game of the season, it was obviously seen around everywhere, but I still bowled a lot in that game. You know, so it's not really necessarily that's the issue. I think potentially we could look at using a different cricket ball. You know, I think I see everyone go on about the pitches a lot. If I'm being honest, I don't think the pitches look too different to what they used to, but I think the Duke's ball is getting more and more. There's certainly the seam seems to be getting bigger and bigger, and there's more and more coating on it every year, I think, or certainly more than there used to be. So I think that's as big a part as it is as the pitches, because you know, like we have some nets where the ball seems all over the place, and then we switch to T20 and we get the white balls out and the ball doesn't move on them. So I'm not sure we can always blame the pitches. I think looking stuff like that. But yeah, the other thing is, I think we've got to realise, you know, cricket's played in England. We play our county cricket in England. You know, you're going to bowl a lot of seam and you're going to have some wet days. You know, but ultimately teams still need a good spinner. Good spinners bowl a lot of overs. So for me, all I want to see is just a bit more sort of attention to it. And, you know, could we use a different ball for a few games, or could we have a few more spin bowling coaches around? You know, we don't have one at Hampshire, but we have myself and Dawson. We sort of help each other a bit, and obviously a bit of outside help as well and stuff. But yeah, you know, could you, I don't know, find a reason to have more spin bowling coaches in the country? That'll always make people better. But yeah, to be honest, I think, you know, expecting a really, really good leg spinner in every side is about right. But, you know, of that, you know, it's not all going to be leg spinners. So I don't think we should expect that. But when we do get a good one, I think you try and nurture them the best way you can, give them as good a coach as you can. And then, yeah, don't just sort of pick them when it's right.
And that is the key. That is the thing that I always mention when it comes to not just leg spin, with off spin as well. I do feel like nowadays, in particular with the, you know, the advent of someone like Rashid Khan, for example, who has dominated world cricket from such a young age, I feel like leg spinners and off spinners at times have ridiculous, you know, expectations at such young ages. I mean, if you look at the, you know, if you look at research into this, the vast majority of leg spinners and off spinners on average in world cricket really reach their peak at around 27, 28 years of age. That is the ideal age range for an off spinner or a leg spinner to have perfected and honed their art enough to become a real weapon. Of course, you'll have really fast starters and you'll have late developers. It's cricket. There's variation. We're not all the same. But that is something that I've always thought about, not just in this country, but also maybe in a more global perspective. I feel like at times we expect 20, 21, 22-year-old spinners to be the next Rashid Khan instead of treating them, you know, separately, understanding that they're not going to be the finished product at such an early age. So that's something that I think I would personally change in terms of the attitude towards spin. Just one other one from James Mason. We have got another couple before we end today's podcast. What are your thoughts about Brad Taylor's retirement? Because obviously both him and Ryan Stevenson, your teammates, have retired this week from professional cricket. Do you just have any thoughts about that? Any words for Brad, of course, now that he has entered retirement?
Obviously it's... obviously, it's a shame and stuff, but, you know, obviously knowing Brad and having spent so much time with him over the years, we've been the same age growing up and we've played all our age group stuff together. We've played for England 19s and Obviously, Hampshire first team as well. I know it's a shame to see him go, but yeah, ultimately, that's what, you know, sadly, what injuries can do. And, you know, Brad has struggled with injuries. And yeah, as someone who's had an injury before, I completely sympathize with him having to go through that and what he has got. So, you know, it's a real shame, and I'm gutted because, you know, obviously the game loses a talented cricketer, but you know, sadly that's it's part of it. And yeah, no, I think it's been a really tough time for Brad having to sort of deal with these injuries and try and play through them and, you know, stuff. So yeah, you know, obviously, yeah, so it's a big shame, but, you know, we all sort of wished him well, and I hope he, yeah, finds happiness in his next chapter. But yeah, no, so it's a real shame when anyone has to retire to injury, and, you know, we wish that they weren't part of the game, but sadly they are. And yeah, it's just how it is, unfortunately. But yeah, like I said, we all wish him the best in retirement. And yeah, it's sad, but it's what it is.
Exactly, Mason. And you know what, myself and Joe, we both echo those words, don't we, Joe, towards Brad and, of course, Ryan as well.
100%.
I mean, 100%. Two excellent pros. They've done a lot of good things for Hampshire over the years. And it is a massive shame. I'm going to be honest, when it comes to retirements, and in particular retirements from injury, they're tough. They really, really are tough, in particular when you've got such talented cricketers who have got such a natural gift for the game. Yeah, it's never easy to see, but of course, wishing those two nothing but the very best of luck heading into the next chapters, of course, in their journeys. Right then, Mason, our penultimate question for today. And I actually do have the last one, because we've it's been alluded to, actually, over the past few podcasts. But this is from Luke T. Okay, and he says, were the conditions at the SCG in your Test debut the toughest that you've ever played in? And he said, I was there that week, and he said his sunscreen started turning into milk on his legs.
To be honest, yeah, probably was. Yeah, I've never experienced heat like that. Yeah, it was 50 something degrees, and going out to field in that. I remember changing my spikes every sort of four or five overs I bowled, just because they were getting so hot. Just the heat from the pitch and stuff. So I had to keep changing my boots. But when I was there for grade cricket the year before, they called grade cricket off at 47 or something like that. And I think it's
47.
So we had a week called off for heat. And then the year after, I was playing in quite a bit hotter than that. So yeah, no, it was unbelievable. Like, I've never seen heat like it. Remember the ground was like nearly pretty much full, but wherever the sun was, there was just no one there. Everyone was just camped at the back under the shade, trying to desperately get themselves an ice cream.
I cannot believe the words 40 and 7 just came out, to be honest. I struggle when there was a game this year in village cricket. We're batting in about 35. I think that's the most I've batted in. Joe, what about you? High 30s?
Mid-30s? Yeah, I batted in high 30s, but I always wear long sleeve. So long sleeves and inners, and I'll never not wear long sleeves when I bat. So yeah, that's pretty stupid of me, I guess. So I would have if I was playing in that kind of heat, like where you were in Sydney, I would have worn long sleeves 100%. So yeah, just I don't know why I always just like to bat in long sleeves. I don't know.
I think that is absolutely ludicrous. For me, short sleeves, as little layers as possible, plenty of sun cream.
All right, okay. Maybe not 47 degrees. Maybe that's a bit of a... But certainly in like 30 degrees in England, you know, the sun goes behind the clouds and you suddenly get cold in short sleeves. So, yeah.
Joe, we'll have to test that out one of the days, won't we? When you finally have the courage to face me in a next session. Mason, to end today's podcast, I did allude to it just there. There has something which has cropped up a lot when your name has came up on the podcast, in particular from your teammates. And it's your knowledge of cricket squad numbers, right? And we have been waiting for weeks, if not months, to try and test this out, okay? We haven't given you any advance warning, okay, listeners? This isn't scripted. It's not prepped, okay? We wanted to test this out for ourselves, right? So I've got three numbers, right, in front of me. An easier one, a more difficult one, and then the hardest being the last one, right, Mason? So the first one is a Warwickshire player. Who wears the number 14 shirt for Warwickshire?
Oh, that's a really good question. I can see it. Of course, it's Briggsy, isn't it? Yeah, it's Briggsy. I was trying to think. I thought it was Lamb or someone, but I thought no, he's 7, Haynes 16. Yeah, Briggsy. Yeah, no, it's interesting with squad numbers. I don't know why. I really pick up on them. So I more than anything, I want to know why. Like, I want to know why you've picked that number. That's more than any. And if someone's got like a bit of a quirky reason why, that really helps me remember.
Do you have any reasons behind squad numbers personally?
Good question. Yeah. Well, so obviously we're 32 Hampshire.
Yeah.
I think it's long, but a lot of people believe I want to wear 23. Obviously, 23 is retired at Hampshire. Obviously, because of Warren. But I don't actually. 32 was my first, one of my first football shirts.
Who was on it?
It was me, but it was I got an Arsenal shirt.
And good choice.
I looked down the list, and 32 was the first number available. So I put myself in as 32.
That's smart. That is very smart.
And I've just sort of liked it. And then when it came to picking a number, I always wanted it really.
I like 32. 32 is a good number.
I've always wanted it, but that's sort of a little reason why. And then I wore 44 for England, but I just got given that. No other reason. I just got given that. That's for me. I'm more than anything. I just want to know why they wear them, and then it just sort of sticks with me.
You see, that's interesting.
Have you ever asked people why they wear their numbers?
Oh yeah, no, I ask everyone. Yeah, I ask them all the time. Yeah.
Any interesting stories?
No, it's like Brad Wheel wears 58. I wanted to know why. It's because he didn't know, and his house number is 58 at home in South Africa. So he just said 58. Yeah, but no, I just like knowing why, really, more than anything else.
You know what, Joe? Maybe we need to start asking that on the podcast. Maybe that's a question we'll start asking. Maybe and then, Mason, if you ever need it, exactly.
Everyone, you've got a reason for something, you know, like you must do. If someone's birthday or something, or, you know.
Favourite footballer, yeah.
Something like everyone must have a reason.
I'm absolutely chuffed that we found the bomb at that, though. I thought there would have been something, you know. Well, to be honest, I probably would have thought that about Warner. I'm going to be completely honest. That shows how much I know. Because it was 23, and then you know you just swap the two numbers around. But that's a nice backstory. I like that, Mason. Does show that it's got a lot of meaning then, with regards to that shirt number. And talking of shirt numbers, this next one, let's go down to the South Coast, more towards your neck of the woods, as opposed to Birmingham. Who wears the number 40 shirt for Sussex?
Oh, the young guy, Ibrahim.
Final answer.
Yeah. Yeah, his first name's Dan, isn't it?
Well done, fair play. It is.
How do you know that?
Oh, that is impressive.
How many times have you ever played against him? What, like once, twice, or never?
Yeah, no, I just, yeah, I would have.
That's such an obscure piece of knowledge to know.
Yeah, if I play against a team, I will generally pick up on what they wear. Yeah, I've always been the same.
That's incredible. Joe, I'm going to be honest. I don't think either of us would have got that.
I wouldn't have had a clue.
But obviously, we know Daniel. He's an incredibly gifted young cricketer. But straight away as well, the young lad, Ibrahim. Fair play, mate. And it's niche general knowledge, but...
It's pointless.
Hey, it's not pointless because it's here on the podcast. So there we go. Maybe we found the meaning behind it, so you can go on podcast and show it off. Right, our final one then. Let's go to Kent. Let's go to the southeast for this one. I'm going to give you a pretty difficult one here to wrap up the podcast, Mason, right? Who wears the number 14 shirt for Kent?
Oh, wow. Who does wear number 14 for Kent? Oh, yeah, I know who it is.
You know, but you can't remember his name.
Yeah. Did he get... See, I'm right thinking he went to Eastbourne or something like that. Oh, I've drawn a blank with his name, but I do know who it is. He scored runs in the last game, didn't he? Yeah, no, I know who it is. I just don't know. I've just forgotten his name.
Do you want us to tell you, Mason?
Please do, yeah.
It's Tawanda Muyeye.
That's him. Yeah, no, yes. He did score runs the last game, didn't he?
Sure he did. Again, yeah. Another very, very good young prospect in county cricket. That was a really difficult one because obviously Tawanda is very, very new to county cricket, but definitely someone to watch out for. I'll tell you what though, Mace, in particular, the first two, incredible knowledge. As I said, myself and Joe, maybe not so much with Warwickshire, I'm going to be honest, I would have got Danny Briggs, but incredible recall. So fair play. After months and, you know, almost a year of searching for the answers, we can confirm that Mason Crane does know his squad numbers. So that is something that we approved here on the County Cricket Podcast today. So Mason, I think that is a wonderful place actually to wrap up today's episode. I don't think I'm alone in saying this, am I, Joe, to say that we have thoroughly enjoyed every single minute
100%
of today's show. Just before we end though, Mason, anything to quickly plug or promote? Any social media channels, websites, anything like that, for example?
No, none of that. Just thank you very much for having me on. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Well, that is fantastic. We always love that when our guests say that. And the pleasure is all ours, Mason. It's been an absolute pleasure and a delight to have you here on the podcast today. So that is it from us three here at the County Cricket Podcast for today's episode. To all of you wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.